Hi, and welcome to Module 1, Lesson 5. Well, we're already at the end of the first week. It's pretty amazing. In this session, we're going to be looking at the member states and their missions to the UN. And as we will do pretty much all the way through this training, we're going to take two main approaches to each topic. We will deal with definitions, measurement, descriptions. We'll connect you to lists and link you to important and more visible aspects of the topic, as we will in this case for the member states. And so we will go over the growth of the member states at the UN, a little bit about what an ambassador is, their role and responsibilities, and where you can find them online, where you can get the information as to where they actually are physically based in New York City, etc. And secondly, and importantly, we'll continue to raise some of the implications of these more tangible aspects of each topic. And some of these rather quickly become quite complex and could be seen as being rather mysterious because they're harder to track, harder to measure, but yet nevertheless, the very real and the impact on and implications for your work as an NGO at the United Nations are very real. So, for example, in the case of the member states, we're going to be looking at the challenges of the growth of the number of member states. We'll be looking at multilateral engagement and what that means, and we want you to do some homework that'll let you experience in that and therefore reflect on it and see what you can learn from that. So we'll be looking at things like the challenges of multilateral engagement compared to bilateral engagement. Now, some people will want to reduce this to good and bad, bi is good and multi is bad, or perhaps some people will think of the other way around, because many people do want to translate everything into a very simple content management system, as I call it, of good and bad, you know, putting things in the good bucket or the bad bucket, and then they simply know what to do with them. You throw the stuff in the bad bucket out. But I would encourage you to not just so simplistically label things either good or bad. And I would like you to try to observe how much you do that, just as an exercise for you. After all, this training is designed to expand your capacities to operate effectively in the UN environment and to intentionally affect planned change. Now, this requires, generally speaking, this will require a shift in your current perspective and understanding. And a part of how you will get there is by being willing to consider the world as you know it a little bit differently. In other words, if you are to be a change leader or engaged in facilitating change, one of the first places that we need to develop our own capacities is in the area of understanding, managing, and directing change. And one basic skill is to be able to look at one picture, situation, set of circumstances, and to be able to see it at least from a couple of different perspectives. Perhaps, for example, here, the young lady or the old hag. Which one do you see? Can you switch between both? And are there, in fact, other ways to look at this picture? And so, especially when you get into multilateral environments, the ability to at least understand a number of different perspectives is imperative to be able to work effectively and strategically. So right now, let's go on back to the member states, and beginning in particular with the member states' growth. Now, back in 1945, it began, as mentioned earlier in previous lesson, we began with 51 member states. And this grew throughout the years until the point where we are now in the year 2010, going on 2011, where we have 192 members. Now, when you stop and think, when you've got a group of roughly 50, it's quite a different dynamic than when you've got a group of closer to 200. It's well known that there tends to be an inverse relationship between performance of groups and their size. There needs to be shifts and changes in leadership for it to be effective. For example, leading by example loses its effectiveness in larger groups. So leadership at the United Nations has needed to evolve over time, and that's still one of the contentions really underpinning a number of the discussions that take place at the United Nations, is how to make the United Nations more effective, how to get it to fulfill its mission and its mandate to secure global peace. So you can look a little bit more just to see how the member states have evolved. You might be interested to look when your country actually joined the United Nations. Montenegro was the last one that joined in 2006, and Switzerland just before that. It had been an observer state for most of those years, and only very recently become a voting member. You can also find the missions online at this link here that we've provided, and you can get to most of the UN online websites from here. If you're interested in a particular country's participation in any of the main organs or committees, you can find that from here. But don't worry too much about that for now. I just wanted to point that out to you. We will be going into that in more detail next week. Now, some of the implications of this growth. In addition to leadership issues, globalization has, with its social, its economic, its environmental, and political dimensions, has created new levels of complexity for those tasked with international responsibilities to manage. These become part of the day-to-day experience over at the United Nations. Obviously, when you've got many countries, many different stakeholders, many people with different cultural backgrounds, political agendas, stages of technological development of the infrastructure of the nation, discussions on any topic very quickly become complex. That can mean that there are barriers to agreement, and so there is no quick conclusion to matters that some of the stakeholders may want to see. Others, however, may, by the very nature, simply want to have no quick closure on the issue at all. Let's just bring this a trifle closer to home. Even between two people, let alone two nations, it isn't always the simplest thing to agree on a particular topic or discussion. You multiply that by 192, and clearly getting agreement is not something that is fast and quick. And so oftentimes people will then reduce this very simply to a positive or a negative assessment of the UN as a whole. When something becomes very time sensitive, and there is a larger group of people, of course, this is another obvious challenge to the effectiveness of the United Nations. Having to get the agreement of many really does affect relationships. So I think you can see that out of these effects alone that come from the growth of the size of the membership, in addition to the context within which it's operating at this time in history, that UN's popularity and or people's attitudes towards it, and when they think about whether or not it's needed, important, and effective, can vary greatly. Now, this brings me to just one point that I would like to raise here. Again, overall, this first week is really skipping lightly across many different areas to try to give you a general lay of the land. But here, because we're dealing with member states, and in this particular part of the lesson, we've been looking at the issues of change and the challenge that the United Nations is facing as an institution endeavoring to still be highly relevant to the changes that are underway in the world. It occurred to me that this was kind of a very interesting quote. Now, this comes from Dag Hammarskjöld's book Markings, and it's one of his written meditations on Confucius' grandson, Zizi, his work that's often translated as The Unwobbling Pivot or The Doctrine of the Mean. And so I'd just like to read this. Looking straight into one's own heart, and there's his commentary on this meditation, as we can do in the mirror image of the Father, watching with affection the way people grow, as in imitation of the sun, coming to rest in perfect equity, as in the fellowship of the Spirit. Like the ultimate experience, ethical experience is the same for all. Even the way of the Confucian world is a trinity. Now, for Dag Hammarskjöld, that was his reflection and meditation on a Confucian writing. But what I wanted to underscore here was the second part of that trinity of actions and its relevance for interaction amongst nations and peoples at the United Nations. At the global level, patience and affection for the way people grow is not something that is often, if ever, talked about. Yet perhaps as Zixi and Dag Hammarskjöld spoke about, when combined with the initial action to look into one's own heart in a very straight, direct, and forthright way, coupled with the affection of allowing others to take the time to grow, may mean that can, in the end, come to rest in perfect equity. Perhaps that is one way that we could promote as a significant contribution to the peace process. Now, while this kind of meditation, musings, and the contemplations of Dag Hammarskjöld created the attitudinal basis for his approach to his job as the Second Secretary General of the United Nations, he noted in his maiden speech as the UN Secretary General that ours is a work of reconciliation and realistic construction. This work must be based on respect for the laws by which human civilization has been built. It likewise requires a strict observance of the rules and principles laid down in the charter of this organization, and that my work shall be guided by this knowledge. So that's how he saw the work of the member states, to be that of reconciliation and realistic construction, but grounded in the laws and principles that had been developed by human civilization to date. Now let's more specifically look at the work of and the responsibility, the role and mandates are for ambassadors. Now this is the framework within which they are to work for reconciliation and realistic construction. Let's see where this is possible and where some of the sticking points may be. And through this, as we look at what the ambassadors as representatives of their heads of state to the United Nations, that we can see as NGOs what we are contending with, the mindset that we are dealing with, what some of the components may be that we can be aware of as we interact with the diplomatic community. So, realizing first of all that an ambassador or the diplomatic group in a mission are representatives of their member state, of their government, of their and the ambassador in particular, of the head of state at the United Nations. Now, they bear the credentials in the form of a sealed letter signed by the sovereign head of state, indicating how the ambassador's negotiations will be regarded, and there are a few different levels. We also need to look at and understand that an ambassador's job is to be responsible for understanding the culture in which they live and work, while also keeping the best interests of their home country in mind. So they also have to be very well aware of what it means to live in the environment of, for example, the New York metro area in America. For some of them coming from other countries, this is a big cultural difference. And they also need to understand the unique community of the United Nations as a multilateral environment, as one that has a culture of its own. And they have to adapt to that and still in that environment work to keep the best interests of their government and their nation in mind. They are expected to represent the views and standpoints of their home country and vote on issues accordingly. And that may mean in some instances that their personal preferences, opinions, and ideas may, in fact, differ quite significantly from that of their nations. However, their job, their responsibility, their mission is to represent their country, no matter what. And as NGOs, as we approach ambassadors, as individuals, and in their position as ambassador, we need to be fully aware of these components of their life and the fact that they have to deal with everything on a day-to-day basis in this way. And there's more. Ambassadors have the task of working with other ambassadors to pass legislation that will bring positive change to all countries involved. They're responsible for understanding the full scope of the world's key issues. So many times an ambassador may be assigned to the United Nations and it may be his first time there. It happens quite often that an ambassador to the United States is transferred to New York City from Washington, D.C. to be the ambassador to the United Nations, and in fact, vice versa. Ambassadors also must gather lots of facts and regularly report back to their home country on the topic and the issue at hand. And they really are to be true liaisons. It's not just a matter of expressing their opinions and their who they are. Their role is to represent their country, and in dealing with the United Nations and other countries at the United Nations, they then are to report back to their capital with their best understanding of the dynamics that are going on at the UN, the issues that are being raised, and the impact that that can have on their country. And sometimes, just sometimes, those countries do not really want to hear the consequences of things that are going on at the global level for their nation. And sometimes the ambassadors don't have an easy time communicating to their capital the ramifications of many of the dynamics and negotiations that are going on at the United Nations, and yet that is their task. It is not an easy job. Now, ambassadors are either considered ordinary or extraordinary. Some of them, you will notice in their description, they are the extraordinary and plenipotentiary ambassadors. Now, the ordinary are those that are often sent on permanent missions. The extraordinary are those that are employed on a particular or extraordinary occasion and sometimes residing at a foreign court or organization for an indeterminate period. Now, here, I've added in here down at the bottom, and I've put here a note that de Vattel, who was around in the 1700s, he was a Swiss philosopher and diplomat and legal expert whose theories laid the foundation for much of modern international law and political philosophy. I just put that in there. You can go and find it at this website. You can go in and read some of the documents there, just for those who are particularly interested in this area. Now I'm going to keep moving on because the time is going already. Where are the missions? Some people ask, do they have offices in the United Nations? Well, no. While they are the United Nations, they are the members of the United Nations. In terms of the UN headquarters, the campus of the UN headquarters between 42nd Street and 48th Street and 1st Avenue and East River, no, they do not have offices there. They have their own missions. Just a simple note. Countries have consulates in other countries, but the offices that work with the United Nations are referred to as missions to the United Nations. And as an aside, I do have to stress that their work really is like a mission. So often, the member states, other than the very large ones, they have totally inadequate staff for the full scope of the work that they are expected or need to handle at the United Nations. And so very often their work really is almost missionary work. They have to work very long hours. They have to do many, many tasks. The ambassador in the smaller missions, oftentimes their wife is the secretary and or bookkeeper, and the ambassador is expected to keep up with so many committees, relationships, and issues. It's just absolutely impossible to do. And this often forms a backdrop for the diplomats that we engage as NGOs. And this is important information to consider when developing your strategies and your agendas for outreach at the United Nations. But more on that later. Suffice here to bring this to your attention and to note that we will look at this again later on. Back to our agenda for this class. Here, very quickly, where can you find them? You can find them online at this link here. And you can find the information, telephone number, fax number, exact postal address, all of that kind of thing. And they change quite often. Not so much the postal address or even the telephone numbers, though they do change. But you'll discover as we go further along that it's very important to be aware of the changes of the diplomats. And so the UN Blue Book, in terms of protocol issues, which is why it's produced by the Protocol Office of the United Nations, is a very important document. And again, we'll go over that more later on, but I did want to at least introduce you to where you can get information that is vital to those who are very active in advocacy and lobbying at the United Nations. Now, in fact, we've covered a lot of territory in today's lesson. What I want you to do for your homework today is plan on having two discussions. Now, I want both of these discussions to be on one issue. And if you're up for it, then make it a controversial topic. That way you can really enjoy learning and observing. Now, the first one I want you to have is with just one person. In other words, I want you to have an experience of a bilateral engagement. Then I want you to have the same discussion, on this, at least on the same topic, won't be the same discussion, but the same topic, with at least two people, so that you can experience the multilateral environment. Now, ideally, these others will have divergent perspectives, different cultural backgrounds, different political perspectives, possibly different religious and values structures. And that way you can really experiment with the differences between the bilateral and the multilateral engagement. So note the difference in how you approach the discussion, what you are likely to say or not say, and also importantly, what you feel were the outcomes of the discussion and how they differed. Now, don't forget there's a strong tendency to see that the one-on-one conversations, the bilateral conversations, are more quote-unquote fruitful. But I want you to see kind of a bigger picture of what you feel that the three or four of you that engage in this multilateral engagement, what are the challenges and what are the benefits of having that quote-unquote bigger discussion. I want you to really look at this and to consider this. This is your homework. Now, you actually have not just one night to do this homework, you've got a whole weekend. So do make a point to consciously have these two different kinds of discussions and to observe both yourself and the others who engage in these, how they feel in these two different types of relationships. And actually a third point, not just two, but a third also to consider the outcomes of the two different kinds of discussions. And not just from a personal point of view, but from the point of view of the benefit of all of you as you engage in the multilateral and the bilateral discussions. And with that, I wish you a wonderful weekend. I hope that you have enjoyed this and that you can look forward to exploring more about the United Nations and the international sphere, and that we can meet again next Monday for our next session. Have a great weekend.